The difference in the way Tadzio is perceived in the novel and the opera is then in the opera, he's not only just a beautiful boy, but he's quite a vigorous character. I mean, he partakes in the games of Apollo, he's played by a dancer, he's leaping around. What do you think about the way he's perceived, maybe shifting the nature of Aschenbach's love for him between the novel and the opera?
It is quite interesting, and it ties back into that line we were talking about how in the book he notices that Tadzio is very frail, and that's an interesting and pleasurable thought to him, whereas that doesn't seem to show up in the opera, and Tadzio is much more athletic and vital and so on. And I know when I came across that line in the book, it made me think of the whole Apollo-Dionysus dichotomy, because there's the Apollonian idea about beauty where it's perfect and unchanging and eternal and so on, and then there's the other idea of beauty, which is, it's temporary, it's ephemeral, it's like a flower that wilts the day after you cut it, that kind of thing. I think the fact that it doesn't come up in the opera changes the Aschenbach-Tadzio dynamic just a little bit for me, where it's more of a straight-up admiration of him rather than a contemplation about beauty and whether beauty is something that is fundamentally decaying. Mm-hmm. Although I think that's a very, very complex issue that I haven't done a lot of justice to, but I think maybe the emphasis has shifted just a bit.
There's a really good blog post you did about that there.
That's right, I did write about that.
Absolutely, and I think that was all very well put, but I think he does try and address it with these questions as you've just raised in the section I have quite near the end, where he's talking about Socrates and Phaedrus and Under the Tree and
that's
so on.
True,
that
yeah. Yeah.
That's his attempt, and it's quite a good attempt, probably, to address those issues of as you say, everlasting beauty or ephemeral beauty. From the point of view of what I think about Tadzio in terms of whether he's frail or more athletic, in this particular incarnation of the production, and I think probably in others as well, my feeling is that they have chosen rather cleverly with Tadzio from the point of view that he, although he isn't frail, he is, there's something slightly simpler about him physically. I mean, he's not so obviously rugged. And I think that's more or less been the case in other places as well. They choose someone who is slightly less, maybe mature physically, mm-hmm. And I think that's clever, and it works for me. But given that you have to have dancers because the piece is constructed with the children and the people on the beach as dancers, I think they've chosen, especially in this case, probably chosen very cleverly.
Now you've done this production with Yoshi Oida mm-hmm. before.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the character of von Aschenbach? And do you call him Aschenbach or von Aschenbach?
I call him Aschenbach.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just for brevity, really.
Yeah.
And the von Aschenbach, anyway, he almost sends himself up about that. Not quite, because he can't quite bring himself to do that, but he's been dubbed, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Got an honorary title.
Yeah. How do I feel about him? Gosh, well, where do I start about that? I
mean, it's a big question.
I don't think he's going to be my top of my dinner list. partly because I probably wouldn't understand anything he was saying. It's like the time I once went out for lunch with Jonathan Miller and Richard Jones, the director. This was years ago in Scotland. And I was a young singer. They said, oh, come with us for lunch. And I sat for an hour and I had the faintest idea what they were talking about. So it might be a little bit like that. And I don't consider myself, a total dummy, but it was quite interesting. They just, okay. So I might have a little bit of that with Mr. Aschenbach, certainly with Thomas Mann, I think, who was a raging intellectual.
Oh no, here he goes on about Plato again.
Yeah. I feel very sorry for him. That's the main thing I feel. I can empathise to a certain extent with his situation. I mean, I'm the same sort of age. I hope I don't feel that I've built this kind of totem of my own reputation. I know I haven't, in fact. I should be so lucky. But I've been to Venice. I know all about that, how beguiling and slightly dreamlike or nightmarish it can be as a place. The thing he has for Tadzio, I've never had that sort of obsession for male or female. Love, yes, but it's beyond that. It's like a sick and illness, an obsession in that sense. And I don't think I've ever experienced that, but I can imagine it. I hope I have to imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
Yoshi and I both agree that Aschenbach has a choice. He chooses death. He chooses knowledge and death, rather than wisdom and, well, life of a kind, but life of a totally sterile kind, which he suddenly realizes what his life was. It was a totally sterile thing. Now he's discovered he's discovered his senses, but the price he has to pay is death, and he chooses that.
Yoshihide refers to passive suicide.
Yeah, he does, yes. Mm. Yes. Well, of course, that's also ties in with a Japanese ethic. I mean, that's the passive suicide is very much part of their, without getting too deep into the waters I don't really know much about, but I mean, that's part of their society, isn't it? This feeling that there's honour and suicide is not seen as a bleak or even a sin, but an honourable thing. I agree with him. I think that's his choice. He could tell them, he could all leave, but he, well, in fact, as man did, man left.
Speaking of books, because this is our book club, what other books is everyone reading right now, or planning to read, or have just read? Anything that's particularly exciting to you?
I just finished Cousin Bet by Balzac that I enjoyed very much. I'd never read any Balzac novel before. And then I'm going on to something entirely different, a fantasy novel called A Game of Thrones that other people have told me is very good, but I'm only on page 4 or something like that.
Is that George R. R. Martin?
Yes,
yeah.
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
I haven't read it,
okay.
But it's been recommended to me. I'm not reading anything. I'm terrible.
You're one of our best readers.
I know. I haven't been reading much. I moved recently, so I look at the bookcase. It's all displayed again, and it's just like, oh, God, there's so many books in here I should be reading.
Too many.
Probably Nixon and China is going to be my next
That's
book.
Right.
That's right. We're actually reading that for our winter run.
Yeah, yeah.
The Margaret Macmillan book.
So they're also doing it at the Metropolitan Opera as well.
Yes, that's right, at the same time.
They'll be doing it
about
the same time. So, yeah.
Yep.
I know a few people who've been involved in that piece, you know, all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I actually bought a Kindle.
Oh.
Aha. Uh-huh.
How do you like it?
I love it. And I do read, but I've been reading more. I read all the time. But also, of course, one of the problems when you come away is what books do you take? How much weight is there? When, you know, you're already overweight because of having to bring clothes for 8 weeks and so on. No, I do love it. I mean, it's not as pleasing to have as a book. You know, it's not as nice to look at on the table or to hold, but if you're just interested in reading, it's excellent. So what have I read? I've read about 8 books since I've been here, including Franzen's new novel, Freedom, which I thought was fantastic, amazingly clever and fluent and relevant. What else have I read? Oh, J.G. Farrell, who's an Irish-English writer who died rather tragically in the 70s when was voted one of his books called Troubles. Was voted the sort of non-Booker prize of all time, and set in a 1919 rural Irish hotel populated by elderly spinsters and an ex-Indian army type who owns the place, and it's very good. It's a bit more like sort of Evelyn Waugh, but on steroids.
I noticed in your blog comment you talked about The Real Tadju.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So 2 books by Gilbert Adair, The Real Tadju. Right. Is that a fiction or a non-fiction?
No, that's a non-fiction.
Okay.
That's entirely a factual thing.
And then Love and Death on Long Island, which is inspired by...
Yes, exactly.
Death in Venice.
And anybody read those?
No,
but I'm planning to.
He's a very clever man, Gilbert Adair. Very nice what he does. And you didn't see the movie? There was a movie made of Love and Death on Long Island.
I did see that, yes.
Must be about 15 years ago or something.
With John Hurt.
John Hurt.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I've just finished reading, finally, it's been months, I've been reading other things in between, The Life of Winifred Wagner, A Life at the Heart of Hitler's Bayreuth. And it's big, and it's just very factual. It just sort of goes through, basically, her life, her letters. It was a bit of a hard slog, but it's fascinating reading. And I just finished one evening, it's very short, Alan Bennett's The Uncommon Reader.
Right.
And so much fun, because it's basically what would happen if the Queen became a very passionate reader, and she discovers late in life the joy of books, and it's so funny and very affectionate about being a reader and about her. And yeah, that was just an evening's read. It was great.
I've read a rather, just finished a rather upsetting novel, but I'm trying to remember the name of the author, and I've gone completely blank, but it's called In Search of Adam, and it's an upsetting book. It's to do with child abuse and suicide, but it's very... I think it's quite an important book. It's a debut novel, and I've forgotten the woman's name, Sarah somebody.
We'll have to Google it. In Search of Adam.
In Search of Adam, yeah. A lot of the book is written in the style of someone who maybe would be 8 or 9, which is a hard thing to do. It's upsetting, but I think it was... I'm glad I read it.
Well, why don't we listen to an excerpt from Death in Venice now?
Go for it.
Okay. Would you like to introduce why we're going to be listening to the overture, which isn't actually the overture?
It isn't exactly the overture, no. It's like as if we've had a long introduction, the opera, and then we have the overture. Well, I think it's Britten that is, you know, most inspired in terms of his orchestral writing. You hear the whole orchestra, because one of the significant things in the orchestration of this particular piece was that he used an enormous array of percussion. He was very, very interested in sort of Southeast Asian and Indonesian, that sort of music. And so there's this huge array of, I think there's probably about 5 or 6 players, but they have about 15 different instruments. But in this section, the overture, which is kind of like between Aschenbach being on the steamer in the Adriatic and arriving at Venice, that's what this section portrays, and you hear the whole orchestra.
You can hear the sound of the engine almost,
you
can't
hear
you?
The sort sound of the engine, exactly,
the
and
water.
Of course of all the bells ringing as he gets nearer in Venice from all the campanile. So that's what that section is all about.
Well, we're going to hear this from the world premiere recording of Death in Venice on the London label. This is from 1974, and Stuart Bedford conducts the English Chamber Orchestra.
I was thinking about Peter Piers, the fact that he wrote all these pieces just for Peter Piers, all these tenor roles. I think that must be a unique thing. I mean, Mozart had his soprano and so on, but to write everything for the one singer, they differ, the roles, so much, but for one singer.
What's that experience like for you? Because you are singing a role that was composed, as you said, for this one man, as all those roles were. And you were working with a conductor who worked, obviously, closely with Britten, and Britten didn't conduct the premiere only because he was too ill to.
Yeah.
How's that connection through the decades?
Well, I'm obviously very aware of it. I don't try and make it too big a deal because, you know, I've got to get on with it. It's my thing now. And still Stuart's. You know, he didn't do it then, stop. He's been with the piece ever since. Mm-hmm. There are certain little insights, some of them quite funny, about what Peter Piers did and what I'm doing. Peter Piers had a bit of a memory problem. And he would, in fact, even some of the text actually are his inventions, which Britten thought, that's better, we'll stick to that. So, and notation-wise as well, I mean, one or two things that Stuart said to me, well, I know it says that in the book, but actually we'll do this because that's what Piers did and Britten liked that better. That's quite nice. You know, in any piece, you can't be harking on about the past too much. You just did it's now, you know.
Alan, you've appeared in other contemporary opera. I know that you've recently made your Met debut as Gandhi, as you mentioned before, in Satyagraha. Is that the right pronunciation?
That's right, yeah. Well, I think so.
At the Royal Opera, you're going to be in the world premiere of Mark Antony Turnage's Anna Nicole. Mm-hmm. And we're sort of curious what the source material would be for that, talking about source material, and what role you're playing.
I'm playing the part of the old chap she married for about 9 months, Howard Marshall, J. Howard Marshall II, I think. That's right. Who was in a wheelchair, I think, throughout. So that's...
That'd be quite the makeup job, too.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind. Maybe not so much, because he was about, was he 89 or something?
Oh,
something
like yes.
Now, the thing is, in the writing, as I'm sort of learning it at the moment, he comes across as very sprightly. So I've been looking on YouTube and so on to see if I can see any images of him moving about, but all I can find is stills, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There's lots of her moving about, and everything moving about.
Yeah, it's one of those things, it's amazing. It's, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, and yet the internet was not there, so
I suppose so, yeah. Yes. But then, for instance, there's a scene I'm with her on the red carpet somewhere or other, and you'd have thought maybe that might have been... There might have been a little bit of movie or video or something, but anyway, no, there isn't.
And that premieres when?
February the something or other in London, February the whatever.
In 2011?
Yeah, absolutely, okay. Yes.
Wow. Right.
Yes, yes. I start rehearsing on January the 4th. They're letting me start a little bit later because I'm going to the Metropolitan Opera after this to do Monostatos again. So they're letting me start a little bit later. I just have three scenes, but they're nice scenes. A big scene where I first appear. It's going to be funny.
I think a really interesting range of roles.
Yes, I do. Lucky me. Yes, absolutely. I think that probably that can happen when you get a bit older. You know, you have to kind of branch out a bit. If you're not going to be the Juve lead or whatever anymore, then you have to. Then you do other things.
Is there anything out there you haven't done yet that is like a dream role that you're wanting to do?
I have certain things. I'd love to do Captain Vere and Billy Budd. That's my top. A top wish, if it's on a wish list, that's the top one. But I have, you know, other things as well. But generally speaking, I kind of keep an open mind and see what comes along. But I certainly would love to do that.
Alan, Jennifer and Cecily, thank you so much for taking time out today to come together and talk about this book. For more information about the COC's production of Death in Venice and the recording we've heard, please visit our website at coc.ca, where you can also purchase tickets online. This is Jana Wichelow. Please join me again in this continuing series of podcasts sponsored by DECA, the opera label.